Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. Last year, Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a measure designed to stop the Chinese Communist government and others from influencing the state's public colleges and universities. The countries on the prohibited list are China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Syria, and Venezuela. This week, Florida got challenged in federal court targeting the new law. The lawsuit was brought by two Florida International University graduate students from China whose jobs as research assistants were terminated. Joining them is a University of Florida professor who said he cannot recruit research assistants because of the law. They say the new law hurts their careers and those seeking to work at the state's public universities and colleges. The American Civil Liberties Union is backing them. The ACLU argues the new law will, quote, cast an undue burden of suspicion on anyone seeking to study whose name sounds remotely Asian, Russian, Iranian, Cuban, Venezuelan, or Syrian. Last May, when he signed the bill into law, DeSantis said Florida was taking, quote, action to stand against the United States' greatest geopolitical threat, the Chinese Communist Party. What do you think about this Florida law? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me this afternoon is WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, who's been keeping a close eye on this law and its effects. Danny, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a step back. Can you give us some background on this Florida law, also known as SB 846, and its effects specifically on universities?
Yeah, in just a broad picture, this law identifies people from seven different countries, and it essentially assumes that anyone that is from those countries is going to have a harder time finding employment in the higher education system in Florida, which means it impacts a lot of researchers, or you know, hires for professorships, etc. If someone is in the United States legally and they are not a permanent resident here, or they don't have a U.S. citizenship, and say you came from Venezuela 2 years ago, which we have many people who are in the university system who did that kind of thing. It presumes that they cannot be employed. They're going to have to be cleared by the State Board of Education and the Board of Trustees in order to give them a waiver, essentially. If you don't get the waiver from the state government and you're from one of these countries, you cannot be employed by the university system, which means people that are seeking PhDs from, you know, if you're from China or Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, Iran, Russia, etc., you can't get paid for that at all. You know, there's usually a stipend that comes with a lot of these positions in higher education. You're going to have to first get state permission to do that. And a lot of people are caught flat-footed. They're caught in a position where they're losing out on opportunities that they were relying on and whatnot. And a lot of those factors is what led to the lawsuit.
You know, what's interesting is, by and large, the international students make up a big part of a lot of universities. Here locally, FIU alone has more than 3,500 international students who come from 140 countries. It's a major research university.
It is.
Danny, the students involved in this particular lawsuit, and I might mention we reached out to them, but they did not choose to come on with us. I mentioned the intro, international students from China pursuing their doctoral degrees. Research is essential to earning their diplomas. According to the ACLU, they were terminated from their graduate assistant positions after the law was passed.
Right.
Do you see or are you aware of any options that would be available for students like this beyond just suing the state?
Right. I mean, this is, you know, I've been doing some reporting on this over the last several months. And what happened was is state universities, FIU is one of many, extended offers to researchers, you know, to fill positions that need to be filled, and very important positions for research in Florida and whatnot. And as this law went into effect, and as the state board of trustees, the board of governors, started implementing regulations, FIU sent out a memo in December saying, even if you sent out letters saying, please come to Florida, we're going to hire you, you need to rescind that letter. We can no longer honor those job offers. So this case comes from there's two students essentially that are undergoing studies that actually moved to Miami, one from China, one from New York, on the basis of having this letter. The federal government already cleared them. They spent thousands of dollars in relocating. And then the state says, no, you can't do it. You're going to have to wait until we, you know, clear things up in some way. There's no, you know, exact timeline. It could take many, many months to figure this out. So they're not able to receive any stipend. So they're having to take out loans just to continue their studies. And they're essentially saying this is it's no place for the state government to do this. The federal government is the one that really is supposed to be running national security. And in this case, there's two students that have been kind of caught in the middle. They got job offers. They came to Miami, and then now they got it rescinded, and now they're having to, you know, pay their own way and take out loans and whatnot. And then there's also one plaintiff who's a professor and a researcher at the University of Florida, studying a very important topic in Florida, which is citrus greening, for the largest agricultural product that we have and protecting it. And he says he can't recruit the top candidates for that position anymore. He put out a call for researchers last year. The majority of them that applied were Chinese. He actually selected a Chinese researcher. After this law went into effect, he could no longer extend that offer of employment. And so that Chinese researcher, according to the lawsuit, said, well, I can't work in Florida anymore. And then actually took a position in a different state.
Interesting. Danny, you've written that FIU has prided itself on the international part of its name for decades and has run joint university programs across and around the globe. How have they responded to this, or what's been their message in terms of the lawsuit?
Well, the school themselves have... in terms of the lawsuit, there hasn't been a response quite yet. But in terms of the law in general, the school hasn't said a whole lot. I mean, even in the memo I got, which was an internal memo that was circulated to, you know, people that could hire researchers, et cetera, they said, this is out of our hands. This is a state government problem. The university is trying to work with the state to figure out how to proceed, how to move forward. Here, I mean, the lawsuit comes from all Chinese nationals who are adamant that they are in no way connected to the Communist Party of China. They just were born in China, which is a big part of the lawsuit. It's essentially alleging discrimination because of country of origin. But it's also affecting, in FIU, people from Cuba or Venezuela. I've talked to professors and people that, you know, they're reluctant to speak on the record, but I can say there are Cubans and Venezuelans who came just a few years ago that are trying to do research, many times research on autocratic governments at FIU, that are finding themselves in this limbo where they can't actually be hired or paid to do that work. And the school hasn't said a whole lot, but it is a reality.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is off this week. We're discussing the new lawsuit filed this week that challenges a Florida law that prohibits students from certain countries from being employed as graduate assistants to conduct academic research projects. Danny, Republican State Senator Brian Avila said the purpose of the bill was straightforward, was to prevent sensitive material and academic research from falling into the wrong hands. To your knowledge, have sensitive materials or academic research leaked in the past, or could it?
You know, it is a good question, and it is something that the FBI at the national level does take very seriously, and they monitor the cases of foreign espionage coming through the university system at any level are relatively rare. In the state of Florida, there was a case which in some ways led up to this law from 2020, where there were six cancer researchers at the Moffitt Cancer Center in the Tampa Bay area, which is state-funded. It's not technically a university. But there were six researchers who were fired after they were caught secretly accepting payment from the Chinese government, kind of in an effort to recruit cancer researchers, very top-level cancer researchers, to China. Five of those six researchers that were fired and kind of caught in this were American. But that case did raise many alarms in 2020 and start a series of hearings and investigations and whatnot that ultimately led to this law being passed.
Yeah, we've talked about the fact that this is a lawsuit filed by two Chinese students and one UF professor trying to hire Chinese research assistants. Have you heard of instances where this law is affecting students from those other countries listed? And you mentioned Cuba and Venezuela. Miami has the highest number of residents from Cuba and Venezuela than any other state in the country. I think it's safe to say that this law can affect many students who need to conduct academic research. But have you heard any from those other countries listed?
I have anecdotally. And again, speaking, it's a tough thing because I've talked to some professors at the school that they don't want to air out the business because there might only be one or two people applying for certain positions that might be from those countries, and they don't want to put their name on it because then it would be very clear who they're actually talking about. But there are many people from specifically Venezuela and Cuba that won't be able to take positions at Florida International University or other state universities unless they get this waiver from the state government, which they haven't figured out yet. They haven't issued any waivers so far. And, you know, just to throw a name out there, there's Juan Guaido, who was the interim president of Venezuela. He was recognized as the United States by as the legitimate Venezuelan president. Well, last year, Juan Guaido took a position at FIU. Right? On paper, it could conceivably be that this law applies to Juan Guaido, who is a staunch United States ally. You know, he would have to get a waiver from the state in order to continue that employment that he has. And, you know, talking to critics of this law, that is the exact kind of situation that's it's hard to comprehend. I mean, this is a Democratic advocate, United States ally, very vocal. He's here on exile. How can he be caught up in this? But this is the law in the state of Florida now.
Yeah, I wanted to take note that the Washington Post reported this week that the Chinese students are actually disillusioned a bit with coming here because of such laws like this.
Right.
And it's not just an issue of hiring Chinese students or those from other countries, but it's an economic factor for universities. Foreign students, by and large, do not, get financial aid. They come on their own dime. So it's a huge amount of money. Danny, do you think there's any way that the state, Florida, would maybe take a step back from this law and say, hey, maybe we should reconsider this given the repercussions?
It's a very good question, and you know, honestly, we'll have to see part of what plays out with this law. With this lawsuit, and you know, just to delve into actually what the lawsuit is asking, the lawsuit is asking the federal courts to declare that this law is a breach of federal law, because they say the federal government is the only party that decides national security issues. The state government has no place in that. And they're basically saying the state is exercising some kind of judgment about national security, and they're doing it through the Board of Governors, which is made up from people that, you know, it's Tim Serio, the CEO of Citizens Insurance, is on that board. Eric Szilagyi, the former head of FPL, is on that board. And they're saying, how do these people, how can they conceivably have as much say about national security as the federal government? This is a violation of the Constitution. This is the federal government's role. And it is a very interesting question, right? In the public statements that were made in the legislature and that Governor DeSantis made when he was signing this, the one country that they continually pointed the finger at in this is China. Now, China was almost always referenced in, you know, the reasoning behind it, but there are seven countries. And it's China, like I said, it's Syria, Iran, Venezuela,
North Korea, and Russia. It's interesting. Again, it appears as if the state might not do that. So let me just wrap this up here. But Danny Rivero is a WLRN reporter. To see more of his coverage on this topic and others, visit WLRN.org. Danny, thank you again for joining us on this topic. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure. Still to come, Miami-Dade created a new tourism district that expands amusement operations in the county's rural Redland farming area. What does this mean for the area and its residents and the future of the agriculture industry? Please call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. Earlier this month, Miami-Dade commissioners created a new tourism district that expands amusement operations in the county's rural Redland farming area. They did so despite opposition from residents and agriculture officials. The proposal will allow more buildings and parking. Residents fear more development will dramatically change the farming vibe that once defined the area. Opponents also argue that creating such a district essentially bypasses protections set in place by the boundary created decades ago to protect dwindling farmlands. It's only the latest chapter of the rural Redland, which has come under increasing pressure to develop as Miami-Dade County grows. Do you live in the Redland? How do you feel about this new tourism district? Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Here in the studio is Jenny Stiletovich. She is WLRN's environment editor and has been covering the Redland issue. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Provide us first with some history and background. When was the idea of a new tourism district born?
Well, so the state back in 2013 actually created an agritourism law that would dictate how these expanded uses would be used on farmland all around the state. Last year, Commissioner Keone McGee proposed some changes in the Redland. At the time, it was largely supposed to solve the parking problem. There's truck parking down there that's been really gotten out of control, big semi-tractor trucks all over the place. Neighbors were also complaining about increasing noise. So those were kind of the focuses back then, but then it evolved as he began talking to people and became this expanded use of venues and amusement activities that fell under the state's agritourism law, except when Miami-Dade County passed theirs, they tweaked it a little bit and kind of went a little bit beyond what the state law allows. And something else to keep in mind is that urban development boundary that you mentioned. Miami-Dade County has, you know, the ag industry is the third largest contribution to the economy for the county. It's like $1.6 billion. But that ag land is shrinking. The county has done a study that came out recently that found that by 2030, if we continue on the trend that we are, we will fall below the amount needed to sustain the ag industry in the county.
You know, what's interesting too is that, like you said, it's no secret that the farmland is disappearing. But again, given what you just described, what are the main arguments by proponents for creating such a district then?
So farming is tough. You know, it's a tough industry, and farmers all over the state have struggled to stay in business with increased competition and falling prices and just all kinds of issues. And so traditionally they have created these other uses. There's U-Pick farms, you know, that's a big thing that allows the public to come in and experience a farm. It's good advertising for the industry itself. Knott's Berry Farms serves milkshakes.
Right.
You know, there's all kinds of uses. So those had been occurring. I think recently there's been an expansion of breweries and wineries, so that was kind of a push to allow these additional uses. So there were farmers asking for it, but again, like I said, this new law makes it easier for a lot of uses. For example, some of those breweries and wineries, they can sell alcohol that's not produced on site. What you usually think of with agritourism is it's supposed to market the farm. It's supposed to showcase what the farm does. Having miniature golf is one of the allowed uses. I don't know how that highlights farming. but by waiving some of these rules, like certificates of uses that are required, that also eliminates some of the inspection process that you might want in some of these uses, like food and alcohol production and sales. And that's what residents are worried about, and neighbors and other farmers. Let's not forget that the Ag Practices Board of the county opposed this repeatedly.
You know, the commission's vote to create the tourism district was pretty lopsided. The final vote was 10-2. It seems as if the fears are pretty well-founded on the part of opponents. What's been the counter-argument of the proponents to the opponents? Are they getting through with their message?
Well, so the people in favor of it say this is good for business. This is good for the economy. So, you know, there are a lot of businesses. As Miami-Dade County has grown, the Redland has changed. It used to be way more rural, and everything by the zoning required 5-acre lots, so you had some farms, some what we think of traditionally as, you know, row crops and farms, and then nursery container operations. Much of our landscaping comes from the Redland that we find in our yards, and so adding these ancillary sort of businesses would help sustain those things, and that has been, you know, the argument by proponents is this is good for business.
Yeah, as I mentioned, the area is known for agriculture. At the county commission meeting, there wasn't even public comment on the decision. Is there any chance, in your opinion, that the public will be able to fight this action at all? Do you see a court battle in the making?
You know, I don't know. People may challenge it based on what the state law says and whether or not the county exceeds those limits. I'm not a lawyer. but there's a lot of activist groups, and there's a lot of residents who are taking a close look. The idea that this allows and goes beyond the protections that the urban development boundary put in place, that might be a place where there could be challenges.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is off this week. We're talking to WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich, about the new Redland Agri-Tourism District. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Miami-Dade County issued a report last year that noted the disappearance of farmland to development, yet the agriculture business is still big. As you mentioned, it's a $1.6 billion industry, third largest in the state. What do you see as the future of farming in the area? Is it inevitable that the rural Redland is not going to be so rural?
Well, so what farmers worry about, too, is that as more businesses come in, more residents who aren't used to a farming life, that erodes that. You know, when you farm, you have to get up at the crack of dawn. You know, right, the farmer's right. schedule is a little bit different than like somebody who operates a bar. And there are worries that those two uses are going to conflict with one another. And so as commercial uses spread, they'll come into conflict with agricultural uses. And the people who want to protect farming and make sure that it survives are very worried about that. I talked to several residents down there, a couple of farmers, who say, you know, when there's a wedding and there's noise that goes until 11 o'clock, not, I mean, that's not that late, but for a farmer who gets up at, you know, before dawn, 4:30 in the morning, that can make a difference. And I know somebody who lives next door to a wedding venue, and he said just smaller gatherings can get noisy. And these are people who live there. They live in their businesses. Farmers live on site. So.
Just to be clear, the wedding venue, you're talking about someone decides they want to have their wedding reception or the wedding itself, all on a property down there, right? Is that what you're talking about?
So there's
example?
Venues, and this law allows the property owners to build additional buildings to house those public uses, those additional uses. The state law only says you cannot build any new buildings that aren't associated with farming. So, a 5-acre property owner who doesn't have a farm can't use this law, or by this law could build a facility to house a wedding, whether it's a shed or you know, some kind of canopy or covering or whatever. And that was one of the big objections by Daniela Cohen-Higgins, whose district is partly in the Redland, is this exceeds the state law.
Interesting. Jenny, there's something important that we haven't mentioned, and that's that state law actually doesn't it forbid expanded uses?
Yeah.
As you just mentioned, Danielle Higgins pointed this out during the meeting. Could you explain a little bit about the law? What does the law restrict? And will the county and residents be able to move forward with this district without breaking that law?
Right. So I guess that depends on the challenges. Right now, the county law says that you can build these buildings. Originally, the proposal would have covered would have allowed uses to cover up to almost 50% of a property owner's land. In the compromise that was worked out sort of the night before the vote, it was reduced to just 5% or 2.5 acres. So it's a much smaller footprint than what was originally proposed. But again, those buildings, were not allowed under state law unless they are directly associated with farming. The other thing this law does is it allows these additional uses to go onto land that are not zoned ag. If you say you have a farm, but you're not in an agriculturally zoned area, there's parts of the Redland, you know, that are residential, you can still take advantage of this change in the law.
Again, it just seems like it's inevitable that rural Redland is not going to be so rural as we move forward. As you mentioned, that statistic about the fact that so much farmland is disappearing. Real quick, is this happening elsewhere around Florida, or is this unique to South Florida and Miami-Dade?
Well, so Daniela Cohen-Higgins again mentioned that there's other land zoned ag in Miami-Dade County, and they don't have the same law applied to them. And her argument was like, if we're going to be equitable, then other parts of the county that are zoned ag should also be allowed to do this. So she pointed out that it's only the Redland where this is happening. Statewide, again, there's a state law that allows agritourism businesses, but it's a little bit stricter. Also, you know, we've seen as farms struggle and the need to preserve land increases, the state has expanded its conservation easement program. Mm. Ag Commissioner Wilton Simpson secured $100 million every year to go into buying conservation easement from farmers. This is part of the strategy behind the Florida Wildlife Corridor to expand production. So, you know, I think they're trying to strike a balance between how do we make sure farms survive? How do we preserve our resources? How do we make people happy? You know, it's complicated.
And I'm fascinated by this term agritourism. You know, are there any other counties in South Florida that have looked at expanding?
You know, I'm not sure. I've only covered Miami-Dade County, so I don't know what
It's such a term that seems kind of a contradictory. Does it compare to the Palm Beach County Ag District too, or is that?
I don't think so. I'm not for sure, but I think because the Redland is this patchwork of farms and residents, that it's sort of, you know, more conducive to this kind of a tourism district. You know. In addition to farms, there's some beautiful gardens down there. Patch of Heaven was an old, I think it was a petting zoo a long time ago, but it's a beautiful garden now. And so there are places like that down there. The Redland, I find, is like one of the most interesting places in Miami-Dade County.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those places where you think, you just don't think of farming as part of Miami-Dade, given all the other things in the area, but and how many people are being affected by this particular agritourism district? Is there a number down there?
You know, I don't know what the number is as far as like population wise, but it covers the whole district. Originally, like I said, it was supposed to be limited to Chrome Avenue, and when the compromise was worked out, it was spread across the entire Redland. I mean, something else we should point out, too, is there's a lot of development going on now around the Redland. A lot of us on our drive down to Everglades National Park will stop by. Robert is here. And now when you stop across the street is an apartment complex. Used to be a bean field.
Interesting. Well, Jenny Stoletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Jenny, thank you again for joining us to talk about this important topic. Still to come, everywhere in South Florida is a film set, just maybe not the kind you're envisioning. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sergio Bustos. Tim Padgett is out this week. The author Carlos Orta was supposed to join us on the program today. Unfortunately, he had a family emergency. We hope everything's okay, and we hope to have him on the show at another time to talk about his book. Switching gears here, what do you think about when you picture South Florida, the beautiful beaches, parks, historic sites, even the bowling alleys? Everywhere in South Florida is a film set, just maybe not the kind of film you're imagining. While movie making for the silver screen departed the Sunshine State for tax breaks in Georgia and Louisiana, the industry behind adult content consumed in the small and very small screen is booming in South Florida. Yes, we are talking about the economic engine called pornography. Porn, it would seem, is an integral part of South Florida's DNA, even dating back to Miami's earliest days a century ago. Here with us is Mike Makowicz is WLRN's breaking news editor. He's been reporting on the growth of the industry for the past several months, and he brings us this report.
If you recognize that sound, you'll want to hear this. And if you don't, well, stick with me. From the WLRN newsroom, I'm Mike Makowicz. South Florida is a lot of things. It's a multicultural, subtropical bastion of sunshine and escapism for winter-fatigued tourists. The sound you're about to hear is from a CBS 4 broadcast.
Chopper 4 above the crowds from South Beach to Hollywood earlier today. It was a perfect day to be out on the sand and in the water.
It's a crucial economic engine, with Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties consistently generating more than a third of the state's overall GDP. South Florida is a reveler's mecca for entertainment and nightlife.
Welcome to Miami.
but it's also one of the largest porn production hubs in the United States. Take it from Ivy Davenport, who uprooted her life from Ohio in 2018. She relocated to the Tampa Bay area after traveling to and from Florida for years to film.
The lack of restrictions is a huge one. The weather, and then the ability to work with so many other producers and collaborate with other talent. I think during the pandemic, a lot of performers kind of had the realization that there was this industry in Florida. I think that maybe people had kind of realized it, but not to the extent of like, oh, this is a hub.
South Florida and the Sunshine State at large has long been an industry hotspot. If you live in Broward or Miami-Dade, odds are you've been on a porn set without even knowing it. Or maybe you're into that and just wanted to check it out. All good. Nobody's judging. Not in South Florida, at least. Here's Davenport again.
This is like one of the places to be if you're working in the adult industry. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, during that time and since that time have relocated because of that.
Porn, it would seem, is part of this region's DNA. Some of the most popular studios in the industry are based here and frequently shoot across the region. Studios like Bang Bros, Reality Kings, and Nerd Pass. Those are just some of the big players who brought us films like Bowling with Bang Bros, filmed at AMF Pembroke Pines Lane.
You said we could videotape in here, dude.
On its own website, you'll find information about all the amenities the bowling alley has to offer. Of course, it's 32 lanes, an arcade, pool tables. And if you were to ask Bang Bros, apparently an ideal setting to film an orgy. In 2021, a Bang Bros producer told Miami New Times that there was a clear relationship between Florida's lack of COVID-era restrictions and the apparent surge in talent that have relocated here. At the onset of the pandemic 4 years ago, states shut down and stayed shut down. But Florida entered phase one of reopening in May 2020. That's a little less than a month after Governor Ron DeSantis issued the stay-at-home order. The free state of Florida, as he liked to trumpet, was back in business. And when DeSantis opened Florida, the porn stars came, many of them from other major production hubs. Mike Stabile himself is an adult filmmaker. He's also the communications director for the Free Speech Coalition, a nonprofit, nonpartisan trade group for the porn industry.
With the lockdowns in Los Angeles, it became easier for people who were creating content to shoot a little bit more in South Florida, right? You had this natural audience that was already there, right? You had a base of people.
And studios making porn weren't shooting. Paid work was extremely limited outside of self-managed platforms like OnlyFans or campsites. That's what made Florida so appealing.
They had a little bit more freedom in terms of what they could do.
As of 2023, data from the Free Speech Coalition showed there were an estimated 175,000 adult content creators in Florida, with the majority clustered in the Miami-Dade and Tampa Bay metro areas. That makes Florida one of the largest communities of adult entertainment creators in the nation, second only to California. Think about it this way. When COVID hit, an entire nation's population was at once confined to their homes. That means a lot more downtime.
You had a lot of performers who didn't have shoots to go to and needed to make money. And that became something that really took off because you also have, I mean, I think people think about this in terms of sex, but it was also a way to have connection.
For scores of entertainers working in porn, Florida represented a promised land of new opportunities. But for those who came, there's no precise official figures. No fewer than 1 million people moved to Florida between 2020 and 2023. By the time lockdowns kicked in, Davenport, who we heard from earlier, was already an established creator. And like it did with just about every other industry on the planet, the pandemic challenged conventional business models in porn, especially with the rise of sites like OnlyFans.
I was really fortunate because I had a huge backlog of content that hadn't been posted at the time. you know, like I knew that my backlog was going to have a chunk taken out of it. Definitely was not expecting to go through my entire backlog, which I did.
Despite the explosive growth of the industry during the pandemic, there's still not much of an appetite among lawmakers to regulate beyond what's already on the books. This year, Florida passed legislation establishing mandatory age verification for accessing porn online. And with fairly lax regulatory oversight for performers, the statute governing porn consumption is pretty broad. In Florida, adult entertainers can be prosecuted when activities involve the, quote, promotion, production, filming, performance, and distribution of obscene materials. It's typically invoked when child sex abuse is thought to be involved, but rarely ever else. Lawmakers in Florida, though, felt strongly enough in 2018 to pass a House resolution recognizing porn as a looming threat to families and public health. Here's the resolution sponsor, former state representative Ross Spano, a Republican who represented parts of Tampa Bay when Ivy Davenport first moved there.
And it's the dirty little secret that no one wants to talk about, but we better start talking about it.
Except when it comes to Florida, porn, whether consuming it or making it, isn't much of a secret at all. And if you heard that little ditty at the beginning of this story and thought to yourself, hey, that sounds like the instrumental intro to Pornhub, you'd be correct. For WLRN News, in the porn production capital of the southern United States, I'm Mike Makrovich.
And Mike joins us now in studio. Greetings, Mike.
Hello, Sergio. Glad to be here.
Mike, talk to us a little bit about how you decided to pursue this story and how it came together. Open up the reporter's notebook, if you will.
Yeah, of course. So actually, this story came to be when I was a staff writer at Miami New Times. And I wrote a slew of stories, actually, about porn films. And these were tips that I was receiving from, you know, readers and whatnot about porn films that were being filmed in and around South Florida. And so I wrote probably a handful or so of those stories. And I ultimately got to thinking, I feel like there's a lot more here. You know, let's zoom out and examine the bigger picture. And here we are.
And interesting is it's really a majorly, well, a very big business here, right, in Florida. But I'm curious to know, what have you been hearing from folks in the industry about just how COVID changed the profession, given its presence here in South Florida?
Well, I'm glad you added that qualifier, Sergio, because I think what's important to remember here that South Florida's place in the porn industry, if you will, and its prevalence isn't this like new phenomenon, right? You know, it dates back to, you know, the big boom in the 70s and in the 80s. So that being said, while this isn't a new thing, it's something that came roaring into focus, I think, with the beginning of the pandemic.
Now, you mentioned your report, Mike, that technology has changed as well since the pandemic. You know, is this now an industry that has been opened up to more solo entrepreneurs? Just like any business, technology has had a major impact, but is it just more available for creators, if you will, to enter the business without having the major investments that a film production company would have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, you know, at the onset of the pandemic, I mean, we were all doing the same thing, which is a whole lot of nothing, right? And so when you put that in the context of the porn industry, regardless of where you were, whether you're in Florida, California, Idaho, Indiana, fill in the blank, you know, more often than not, you were going to encounter restrictions as to what you could do on these sets, or more specifically, what you couldn't do, which wasn't a whole lot. And so I think that really cleared the path for the proliferation of, you know, these self-managed sites like OnlyFans. And it really in a lot of respects, gave a lot of agency to this sort of, I don't want to say new cohort of performers, but this empowered set of performers. It really just allowed them to, you know, take their careers in this respect into their own hands and to run with it. And that's exactly what happened.
You mentioned in your piece, but like any new business or changing business, have the regulations caught up in any way? Is this business regulated? Are there licenses issued to the producers, to the performers? What's the regulation environment look like?
It's interesting, and it varies very widely. And so a hot button issue in Republican circles in state legislatures around the country has been the introduction of these pretty stringent, I don't want to say bans, but, you know, regulation measures in terms of who is able to access porn online. I believe it was Texas, for instance, which the governor just signed a bill into law. Not only do you have to verify the fact that you're an adult accessing this content, but you have to provide a state-issued identification to access said content. But, you know, turning back to Florida here, you know, speaking to the regulatory landscape, you know, as I mentioned in this piece, it's pretty broad. The laws on the books that Florida has governing pornography and who can produce it and who can consume it is really, really broad. And so if you were to read the statute as it's written, you might think, well, okay, how is not all of pornography like flying in the face of this statute? And that's because it's really only ever invoked when there is thought to be child sex abuse materials involved.
Finally, we can't lose sight of the bigger production companies. They're still big players here in South Florida, aren't they?
Oh, big time. Absolutely. Again, not that, you know, these production houses, you know, that have bases set up across South Florida. You know, it's not necessarily anything new. They've been around and they're big players. I mean, you have Bang Bros established here. You have Reality Kings. There is certainly no shortage of major production hubs in South Florida when it comes to porn.
Great. Mike Mukrovich is WLRN's breaking news editor. Thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Finally, on the roundup, poetry and your postal code, an ode to your zip codes. We have partnered with the O Miami Poetry Festival again this year, and we're inviting you to write an ode to your zip code during April, National Poetry Month. The rules are simple. Use your 5-digit zip code to write a 5-line poem. Each digit of your zip code determines how many words per line. Here's how it works.
Hi, my name is Julia. I live in Miami, Florida. My zip code is 33145, and this is my zip ode. A confluence of cafecito and contingencies. Sometimes life closes a door and then opens a ventanita.
Still need help? We have you covered. We built a Zipode tool to help you at wlrn.org/zipodes. That's visit wlrn.org/zipodes. That's ZIPODES for more details. Well, that will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateos Sanchez is digital editor. The vice president of radio and shows technical supervisor is Peter J. Mayers. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Sergio Bustos, WLRN's VP for News. Have a great Sunday Easter weekend, and thanks for listening.
WLRN Public Media.